the blockade?
You know, the conditions of restriction and closure and daily monitoring, the overhead drones that one can hear at any time of the day or night, it creates a climate of fear, of certainly that you're being watched at all times, and that you really, as a child, that this is the limit of your world. You know, Palestinians are connected to what happens outside in the world through television, through the internet. They're the most literate people in the Middle East.
You have 10 seconds.
You know, what we do now as the international community to bring justice and change in Palestine is crucial for the future of Gaza.
Pernilla Ironside, Chief of UNICEF's Gaza Field Office, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Special thanks to Aaron Mate and Hani Massoud.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
Good people, we at Guess Who's Coming to Radio are back with our annual celebration of teacher Michael Jackson. On Thursday, August 28th, from 8 p.m. to midnight, we will be exploring previously unreleased works, guest spots, words of wisdom from the teacher, as well as a conversation with Talib York of the tribute band Who's Bad. Stay tuned on August 28th from 8 to midnight, where we honor Michael Jackson on Guess Who's Coming to Radio on KBOO, your community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, toxic chemicals have been found in every waterway in Washington State.
We'll hear about new developments in the fight against the ongoing Ebola epidemic in West Africa.
And the Washington County Board will hold a public hearing next Tuesday on whether to grant Intel a 30-year tax deal.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 21st, 2014. I'm Jenka Soderberg.
I'm Robert Barncord. Protesters are planning to gather at the port of Tacoma this evening to block an Israeli ship that's scheduled to arrive there tonight. This follows a port blockade in Oakland, California that lasted 4 days and blocked the unloading of Israeli imports from a ship that was docked at the Port of Oakland since Saturday. The protesters say that this action is meant to cost Israeli companies economically as part of a global effort to pressure Israel to end its discriminatory policies against Palestinians. The protesters are organizing through Twitter with the hashtag #BlockTheBoat. Their Facebook event page was removed by the Facebook Corporation with no explanation, but there is a website that has information on the upcoming Seattle and Tacoma boat blockades. That website is blocktheboatnw.wordpress.com.
And today is a day of rage in support of the people of Ferguson, Missouri. We'll have a full report, including a live report from Pioneer Square, where there's a solidarity rally going on right now, later on in the hour. In another protest today, Deputy Postmaster General Ron Stroman drew protests from dozens of postal workers and community allies when he visited Vancouver, Washington this morning. The protesters gathered at the entrance of the 2014 Mailers Conference at the Vancouver Hilton. They carried signs, marched, and chanted into a bullhorn that was heard by conference goers throughout the morning session. The protesters chanted, "No closures, no cuts, no contracting out." Ronald Stroman is currently pushing to eliminate Saturday and at-the-door delivery, as well as closing half the mail processing plants and post offices in the nation. Stroman and postal management say these cuts and closures are necessary because the U.S. Postal Service is losing money. But the protesters, organized by Portland Communities and Postal Workers United, say that a 2006 congressional mandate has created a phony financial crisis in the U.S. Postal Service. That directive forces the Postal Service to pre-fund retiree health benefits 75 years in advance. Of immediate concern to the protesters is the projected closure of 82 mail processing facilities, including those in Tacoma, Wenatchee, Bend, Pendleton, and Eugene, beginning this coming January. 15,000 family wage union jobs will be lost in the area, and delivery standards will be reduced, resulting in mail being delayed for 2 to 3 days.
A new report from the Washington State Department of Ecology has found toxic chemicals known as PCBs in every waterway in the state. In addition, tests of 68 consumer products confirmed that polychlorinated biphenyls, as they're known, or PCBs, are present in commonly used items. The Washington Department of Ecology has drafted a chemical action plan identifying PCB sources in the state and recommending ways to reduce exposures. For more on this, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with the lead chemist and toxicologist who produced the report.
We are joined on the line now by a couple of scientists from the Washington Department of Ecology. Alex Stone is a chemist. Holly Davies is a toxicologist. If we could start by talking about what is the scope of PCB contamination in the state of Washington right now?
We see, when we do environmental monitoring, we see PCB contamination everywhere in the state. For instance, in sediment, and we look in fish tissue, we see levels and high levels in fish tissue throughout the state. And the National Centers of Disease Control, when they look in people, they see PCBs in everyone they look in.
For people who aren't familiar, could you talk about what PCBs actually are?
PCBs are large organic molecules, and by organic, I mean there's lots of carbon and hydrogen, et cetera, involved in them. But they also have a lot of chlorine atoms attached, so the same sort of chlorine that you use in your pool and things like that. More importantly, there are basically 209 different types of PCBs, and it depends on the number of chlorines that are involved in each molecule and where they're attached. So that's how you get the differences between the 209 different types. But there's a lot of different types of PCBs, and when you talk about PCBs, you're talking about the whole group of 209, unless you're talking about a specific type of PCB.
And how harmful are these chemicals, these PCBs? How harmful are they?
PCBs are persistent in the environment, so they last for a long time in the environment, and they build up in the food chain, and they cause adverse health effects both in humans and wildlife, including cancer and harm to the immune, nervous, reproductive systems, and they hinder growth and development.
And how is the state of Washington addressing the issue of PCB contaminants that are already out in the environment, as you talked about waterways and places where these contaminants actually are out there already?
The state of Washington is doing a lot of things to address PCBs. We've been working for many years, back before the 1976 ban, on monitoring and cleanup. There's a lot of fish advisories throughout the state to reduce people's exposure to PCBs. We also have, as Alex just mentioned, Governor Inslee had a proposal directed us to move immediately to do more for PCBs. And part of that is our PCB chemical action plan that's currently out for public comment. The chemical action plan identifies sources in the state and recommends actions to protect human health and the environment. And some of these deal with new sources, such as the new newly generated PCBs and consumer products. It also deals with some of the older sources that Alex mentioned, too, the caulk that's still around. How do we keep the PCBs in the caulk from getting out into stormwater and out into the environment? It's an opportunity to manage those PCBs and keep them from getting out into the environment.
Well, thanks so much. Again, that website, if you're interested in finding out more or making a public comment on the Chemical Action Plan in Washington, the website is ecy.wa.gov. We've been speaking with Alex Stone, the lead chemist on this report, and Holly Davies, who is a toxicologist there at the Washington Department of Ecology. Thank you both so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News. A fire last night on the roof of a high-rise office building in downtown Portland was put out within an hour with no serious damage. The fire appeared on the roof of the Yeon Building, an 11-story building constructed in 1911, around 11 p.m. 60 firefighters arrived on the scene and put the fire out. Less than an hour later, police responded to a call of a woman acting strangely on the roof of another office building a couple of blocks away. A 34-year-old woman, apparently suffering from a mental health crisis, had stripped off her clothes and climbed a flagpole on top of the Oregon Bank building. When police arrived, she wrapped herself in the flag while holding a lighter and fire extinguisher. She was taken into custody without incident. Portland police say they do not yet know if there was any connection between the woman and the fire on the nearby Yeon building. The cause of the Yeon building fire is still under investigation.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is moving ahead with a project to fund tiny houses or micro communities as a solution for Portland's homelessness. An advisor for Mayor Hales says that the mayor hopes to have a pilot project up and running within the upcoming year. The mayor has assigned a task force to further investigate zoning and legal challenges. Mayor Hales has reached out to Portland Public Schools, to TriMet, and to Multnomah County for help finding appropriate sites on their surplus land for the one-room houses. Last week, KBOO caught up with housing advocate Mike Withy as he testified to the City Council about micro communities, concepts, and alternative housing options. Withy says the tiny houses could be rented for as little as $250 per month.
I think that we really need to consider the different options we have next year when we do the same thing. I hope that we have better programs in place and less expensive rents and better ideas as far as more space that's available for less. I think that you guys are doing a good job, and like you stated, Commissioner Fritz, last time, there are lots of options. We really don't seem to be exploring those options. I know that I had a meeting with your office. I haven't heard back.
Housing activists worry that neighborhood associations will fight to keep the micro communities from being located in their areas, especially as the question remains over the future placement of the Right to Dream 2 camp in Northwest Portland. KBOO reporter Michelle Lace spoke with Dana Haynes, communication director for Mayor Charlie Hales, about the initiative.
The idea that we're now beginning to look into and examine is whether or not this would be an option for one of our homeless or houseless or house uncertain communities here in Portland. It probably wouldn't solve the whole problem because, as you know, at any given night we have 1,700 homeless people on our streets, but it might solve one particular subset of that group along with everything else that we're trying to do. So the idea is to perhaps build these very, very, very small homes on some surplus land owned by maybe the city or the county or what any of our other community partners, and provide a inexpensive and easy to maintain house for that transitional person who's not yet ready to have a large house. So it wouldn't, as you point out, solve the problem of the person who has no money at all, is completely destitute, and is just, you know, completely out of luck. It wouldn't help that person, for which we then have trying to build more shelters and trying to build more services for that group. But it might serve one of the subsets of our homeless.
Will these micro communities be located close enough to all the resources and services that are concentrated in the city center? or is the plan to create new services on site within each micro community?
Excellent questions. That's the kind of thing the task force will be looking at. Right now, what we have is a very large houseless population, plus we've got surplus lands that the city owns, the county owns, the school district owns, I mean, many of our partners own. So the question is, can we find a nexus between that need and that surplus land to find more than one location, perhaps, you know, multiple venues for this sort of small community of micro houses. Probably it wants to be, almost doubtless, it wants to be on a bus line, on mass transit line of some kind. And if it's that, then that by definition gets it within proximity of some services via the bus. But could we definitely align it where all the services are? Don't know that yet. Still looking into what the options might be.
And there's a concern, I think, among some housing activists that they don't want to push the homeless out of sight, out of mind. Will there be a micro community that stays in Northwest Portland, perhaps near the current location of the Right to Dream Camp?
Superb question. As the task force looks into whether or not we can do this, one of the things we'll be asking is where would we put them, and what would the logical place be for where this might serve? That'll be one of the things the task force starts looking at. Let me add one thing, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
This is an example of one of those things that the community brought this idea to us. We like to take credit for all the brilliant ideas in the world. Quite often, we shouldn't. This is a guy named Michael Withy. Who's a homeless activist, came to the mayor and said, here's an idea, here's something that might work. It's not going to work for everybody. It's not a panacea for all of our homeless, but it is an option to look at. And the mayor was completely taken over by it. He thought, man, this is a solution. This is interesting. We have not tried this. Again, won't solve everybody's problems, but this is an example of the community bringing an idea to us and saying, look, try something. Try anything. We've got to think outside the box. It's too big a problem, and winter's on its way. We've got to help as many people as possible. This is an example of where the community brought the idea to the city hall and not vice versa.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Michelle Lace speaking with Dana Haynes at Mayor Charlie Hale's office.
A new report has shown that Hoyt Street Properties has failed to deliver on its promise to provide affordable housing to the Pearl District in Portland. An analysis by the Oregonian shows that Hoyt Street Properties would need to build an additional 258 units to meet the city's 35% target for affordable housing in the area. According to the Oregonian reporters, this is just the latest example of Portland developers not living up to their promises. In redeveloping the Pearl District, the city spent tens of millions of dollars to tear down the Lovejoy Viaduct and build a new streetcar line. Former City Commissioner Gretchen Kefouri, who voted in support of the Hoyt Street deal back in the late 1990s when it was first approved, says now that, looking backwards, she may have done things differently if she had known what the result would be. Kefouri said that Portland's inability to deliver should give residents pause the next time a big redevelopment project is proposed. Right now, the Portland City Council is preparing a redevelopment plan for Old Town Chinatown. The community activists fear could turn that area into another Pearl District, whose rents are prohibitively expensive for low-income Portlanders.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview conducted by KBOO's Sam Bowman about the tax breaks for Intel and Nike. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, the voice of Portland's African-American community with your host, Sequoyna Wright. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly cloudy with a high of about 81 degrees. There will be no chance of rain. Today in history, on August 21st, 1959, President Dwight David Eisenhower signed an executive order proclaiming Hawaii the 50th state of the Union. Hawaii's admission is currently commemorated every year on August 21st as Hawaii Admission Day. The quote of the day is from Huey P. Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party, who said, "Black power is giving power to people who have not had power to determine their destiny."
The time is 5:19. It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Let's check our weaponry. 93,000 machine guns, 533 planes and helicopters, 180,000 magazine cartridges, and 432 ambush-protected vehicles. Okay, let's roll. Only, this is not the U.S. military. It's you and my local police departments patrolling our cities. Remember Officer Friendly, the beat cops who are known as peace officers? The Friendlies have largely been transformed into militarized forces, literally armed with and garbed in war gear and indoctrinated in military psychology, rather than the ethic of community policing. 20 years ago, Congress created the Military Transfer Program, providing federal grants so chiefs of police and sheriffs could buy surplus firepower from the Pentagon. In a stunningly short time, our local police forces have become macho military units, possessing an armory of Pentagon freebies ranging from 30-ton tanks to rifle silencers. They've gone from peacekeeping beats to over-the-top SWAT team aggression, unleashed on the citizenry tens of thousands of times a year, mainly for ordinary police work. For example, a gung-ho Florida SWAT team raided area barbershops in 2010 to stop the horror of barbering without a license. And mass police in Louisiana launched a military raid on a nightclub in order to perform a liquor law inspection. This is Jim Hightower saying, militarization is a dangerous and ultimately deadly perversion of the honorable purpose of policing, and it is literally out of control. The New York Times notes that 38 states have received silencers to use in surreptitious raids. A sheriff in a North Dakota rural county with only 11,000 people told a Times reporter that he saw no need for silencers. When it was pointed out that his department had received 40 of them from the Pentagon, he was baffled, saying, "I don't recall approving them."
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
In India, 42-year-old hunger striker Iram Sharmila has been released from prison in New Delhi after 14 years of incarceration and force feeding. She was imprisoned in 2000 on charges of attempted suicide and has not voluntarily eaten any food for 14 years. Sharmila began her hunger strike to protest the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which suspends basic civil rights in regions of armed conflict, such as in Kashmir and northeastern states, where a separatist insurgency is taking place. The act allows the Indian military to shoot suspected rebels without proof and conduct warrantless searches and arrests without fear of prosecution. Sharmila was arrested after a number of people, including children, were killed at a bus stop near her home. She was released on Wednesday, looking frail but determined to carry on her hunger strike until the act is repealed. Her case was finally thrown out by courts after 14 years of advocacy by Human Rights Alert. A court agreed that her hunger strike was an act of political dissidence and not attempted suicide by starvation.
Clashes broke out on Wednesday in East Darfur in Sudan between two rival Arab tribes. According to Radio Dabanga, an independent station that covers Darfur, the conflict between the tribes broke out over the theft of a camel, a horse, and two donkeys. It has thus far left upwards of 300 people dead. The recent violence is symptomatic of the current situation in Darfur, where rebellion against the central Sudanese government has subsided and violence now mostly occurs as a result of fighting between Arab tribes. The war in Darfur began back in 2003 when rebels rose up against the government of President Omar al-Bashir, saying that he favored Arabs over black Africans. In the following years, an estimated 300,000 people have been killed and 2.7 million people have been displaced. Many of these people are still in refugee camps patrolled by the United Nations and African Union troops. The war was characterized by ethnic violence, especially the brutal attempts by the Arab Janjaweed militias to drive black Africans out of Darfur. Though there are ongoing and uneasy peace talks between the major combatants, the war has left a legacy of lawlessness, allowing tribal conflicts like the current one to proliferate. According to reports from members of the Sudanese parliament, police battalions have been given the go-ahead to enter the disputed area and disperse groups of armed tribesmen.
In the wake of the murder of American photojournalist James Foley by Islamic State or ISIS militants in Iraq, President Barack Obama has referred to ISIS as a cancer, and the Pentagon is reviewing the possibility of sending in 300 additional troops. The soldiers would join around 1,000 U.S. soldiers currently in Iraq, where the U.S. military presence has so far been limited to airstrikes on ISIS positions and search and rescue operations. According to the Pentagon, the 300 troops would be deployed primarily for the purpose of protecting Baghdad from the ISIS advance. The U.S. Congress remains on the fence about larger commitments in Iraq, with some Republicans, such as Arizona Senator John McCain, calling for increased airstrikes. However, experts have questioned that strategy, noting that ISIS remains the world's best-funded terrorist organization, which now has access to numerous oil fields and border crossings, and may be able to sustain itself without outside donations. It remains unclear how to defeat ISIS without U.S. involvement on the ground in Iraq. That prospect is politically unpopular in the United States, which officially removed its last combat troops from Iraq in 2011. It's also been made clear in videos released by ISIS that U.S. involvement will inspire more fighters to join their cause. U.S. government analysts argue that ISIS must be driven back by ground forces, but they stress the need for the U.S. to make a priority of strengthening the Iraqi military and the Kurdish military force, the Peshmerga. Already, the Peshmerga has recaptured the Mosul Dam from ISIS and strengthened its hold on that important piece of infrastructure. The Iraqi military is currently fighting to retake the city of Tikrit.
Protests continued last night in Ferguson, Missouri, but last night's protests were met with less police violence than in the past few nights, and no arrests were reported. Attorney General Eric Holder met yesterday with the family of the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown, who was killed by police on August 9th. He promised a full investigation of the young man's murder.
Going forward, I will continue to get regular updates and to closely monitor the situation as it unfolds. Now, although our investigation will take time, and although I cannot discuss the specifics of this case in greater detail since it remains open and very active, the people of Ferguson can have confidence in the federal agents, investigators, and prosecutors who are leading this process. Our investigation will be fair, it will be thorough, and it will be independent.
Right-wing commentators across the country have repeatedly accused outside agitators of provoking the ongoing protests against police in Ferguson, Missouri. But a study by the Washington Post has found that more than 80% of those arrested during the protests are from Missouri, nearly all of them from the St. Louis area. Out of the 155 people arrested and taken to St. Louis County Jail in connection with the demonstrations against the killing of Michael Brown, 123 are from Missouri. In addition, of the people arrested, it appears that at least 12 were out-of-town journalists. If that's the case, the percentage of activists arrested from states other than Missouri drops down to just 13%. Just last week, Ferguson Police Chief Tom Jackson blamed protests on what he called outside agitators. But the numbers obtained by the Washington Post paint a very different picture of who the protesters are in Ferguson.
A petition on the site whitehouse.gov calling for all police officers to wear body cameras has gotten over 100,000 signatures. The petition calls for the creation of a new law called the Mike Brown Law, which would require all state, county, and local police to wear a camera. The petition says that the law shall be made in an effort to not only stop police misconduct, like brutality, profiling, and abuse of power, but also to ensure that all police are following procedure. Supporters say the use of cameras would remove all question from normally questionable police encounters, as well as help to hold all parties within a police investigation accountable for their actions. While the White House's We the People webpage allows anyone 13 years and older to create and sign a petition to the government, it does not guarantee any action. If a petition reaches 150 signatures within 30 days, it becomes searchable on the site. If it reaches 100,000 signatures, signatures within another 30 days, administration officials say they will respond to the petition. The police camera petition was created on August 13th. It reached 100,000 signatures in less than a week. Again, it's the Mike Brown Law on WhiteHouse.gov.
In the Gaza Strip today, Israeli airstrikes, which resumed Tuesday night, continued throughout the day and night. A total of 30 people were killed on Thursday, including 5 children. Doctors say they've been shocked by the severity of wounds coming into the hospital. They found evidence of the Israeli military's use of banned weapons, like DIME weapons. DIME is an acronym for Dense Inert Metal Explosive. These weapons create lethal destruction in small areas. The bombs contain a high density of tungsten and other heavy metals, including cobalt, nickel, and iron. They also contain some amount of depleted uranium. Even breathing the dust of the DIME explosive can lead to death as the metal particles spread throughout the body. Today's airstrikes follow an attempted assassination by missile yesterday of a Hamas leader that ended up killing his wife and child instead. The UN Security Council expressed grave concern over the resumption of hostilities in Gaza and called upon all parties to resume negotiations to reach a sustainable and lasting ceasefire. For more on the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, we now go to the International Middle East Media Center.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, August 21st, 2014. Israeli attacks leave 30 residents killed in Gaza, and troops continue to kidnap civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Ministry of Health reported on Thursday night that additional 7 people were killed by Israeli airstrikes, including a child, bringing the death toll to 30 on Thursday. 2 men were killed in an Nasser neighborhood of Gaza City by an Israeli airstrike that targeted a car they were driving. In Rafah, 2 men were killed when an Israeli missile struck their motorcycle as they were driving on the road. Another man was killed near the Rafah crossing. Moreover, a man and a child were killed in the central province and 4 people were wounded. All day on Thursday, Israeli aerial bombardment targeted Gaza City and Rafah, leaving 23 civilians killed and many more injured. According to Palestinian sources, doctors have been shocked by the severity of wounds coming into the hospitals. They have found evidence of the Israeli military use of banned weapons like DIME weapons. DIME stands for Dense Inert Metal Explosive. Since the Israeli attacks started up until the time of this report, more than 2,082 are killed and at least 10,345 injured in Gaza, the Palestinian Ministry of Health reported. Elsewhere, a Palestinian youth was injured on Thursday during clashes with invading Israeli soldiers at the village of Husan near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. The teenager was injured in the hand by a rubber-coated steel bullet fired by Israeli soldiers who invaded Husan and ransacked residents' homes, local sources reported. Earlier, Israeli forces kidnapped at least 16 Palestinian civilians during dawn invasions in different parts of the occupied West Bank, according to media sources. Invasions and kidnappings were reported in the northern West Bank cities of Nablus and Qalqilia, in addition to the central West Bank city of Ramallah. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, August 21st, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, five members of the International Committee of the Red Cross who had been captured by an armed group in western Herat province were released today. They were abducted on August 14th while traveling through the province. No group, including the Taliban, has claimed responsibility for the abduction, and it's unclear why the five humanitarian workers were released. The Taliban has been increasing its attacks of foreign aid workers amidst a general ramping up of hostilities in Afghanistan. In an attempt to disrupt the ongoing election process in the country and destabilize a new coalition government. The government will likely already be at odds with itself when current President Hamid Karzai hands over power. On the same day that the five aid workers were released, the Taliban killed six people, including five police officers, when they attacked a training vehicle in western Herat province.
In Ferguson, Missouri, some independent journalists covering the protests say that they believe police are now using technology to kill live stream feeds during questionable police activity. The most prolific live streamer from Ferguson, Argus Radio, reported that last night, just as police began to rush the crowd, the live stream feed was cut and registered a network error, according to Argus Radio. The Argus live stream has been filming the protests nonstop for the last week, manned by volunteer University of Missouri grad student Mustafa Hussein. Civil liberties groups have warned in the past of the dangers of a government kill switch that could jam cell phone signals. A recent California bill requires smartphones to have kill switches to prevent theft, but critics worry that the government can use them to remotely shut off phone cameras and 4G access. Following the Boston Marathon bombing, cell phone users in the surrounding areas found their cell phones had been cut off for a brief period of time. Across the country today, cities have organized a day of rage in support of the people of Ferguson, Missouri, who are struggling to deal with a long history of police violence in their community. In Portland, the Day of Rage protests is taking place right now in downtown Portland. The chant that has become a symbol of the protests is, "Hands up, don't shoot," with protesters holding up both hands as a symbol of the many shootings of unarmed people of color by police and law enforcement.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Friel and Michelle Lace. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is myself, Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenka Soderberg.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO Radio at 7 a.m., it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe Uris guest hosts Positively Revolting Talk Radio. And at 9, on One Land, Many Voices, the hosts Zaha Hassan and Ned Rosh interview Stanford professor Joel Benin and UCLA professor Sandy Tolan about the situation in Gaza and the decision by the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to rescind its offer of a tenured position for Palestinian-American professor Stephen Saleta. At 10, Air Cascadia will be off, so we'll go to Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, we'll speak with writer and filmmaker Dan Austin. He'll be at the Hawthorne Hostel in Portland on Saturday night for their annual Bike-In movie event, screening his movie, True Fans, an award-winning documentary of three men biking across the United States. Thanks to all of you KABU members for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by simply going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Jenka.
Good night, Robert.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Two new developments in the study of the Ebola virus may be leading scientists closer to an effective treatment. Yesterday, scientists announced that a new treatment has successfully protected monkeys who were infected with Marburg virus. Marburg is a disease with a course so similar to Ebola's that it's impossible to clinically differentiate the two. Separately, scientists in Washington State have uncovered the method used by the Ebola virus to disable the body's immune response. Scientists are hoping that the new research could shed light on a possible treatment for Ebola. For more on this, let's go to KABU's Jenka Soderberg speaking with one of the lead scientists in the new research.
We are joined on the line now by Dr. Gaya Amarasinghe of Washington University School of Medicine and lead investigator in a new study on the Ebola virus. And I wonder if you could start by talking about interferon. What is interferon? What does it have to do with Ebola?
Yeah, so interferons are a molecule that it's a protein that the cell makes under some conditions that cause stress, and one of the stress conditions is the viral infection. So typically when we have a viral infection, say we forget the seasonal flu, one of the ways in which our body is able to cope with the virus and counter the virus is through the activity of interferons. And so it's an essential part of what we call the innate immune response pathway. And this is one of the mechanisms which the body fights back against invading pathogens.
So it's a part of the immune system. And how does the Ebola virus impact it?
Yeah, so viruses like the Ebola virus have a lot of different mechanisms to counter our immune responses. So, for example, in our previous work, we looked at a protein called VP35 that is, again, a filoviral or Ebola virus viral protein. It's one of the functions that it carries out during infections is to prevent the production of interferons. And the protein that is the central theme of this recent study is a protein called VP24, viral protein 24, and its job appears to be, at least one of the jobs appear to be, to inhibit the response or the antiviral effects of interferons. So interferons are these molecules that can go and work in many different cells, and those they can upregulate or activate antiviral proteins.
Well, I think what is on a lot of people's minds is how will this discovery, how can it be used to actually help create drugs to treat Ebola?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so one of the issues that we've had with Ebola infections and the current outbreak brings this to, you know, has brought it to our attention is really that we don't understand the basic virology or the basic biology of how some of these pathogens interact with, you know, humans and animals. And I think that's one of the central issues. So this particular study gives us we've known for a very long time that, you know, Ebola virus and other viruses prevent the innate immune system from activation. So what this study shows us is how it does it. It gives us a three-dimensional structure. So one of the techniques that we used in this case is a tools from structural biology, particularly X-ray crystallography, that gives us a three-dimensional picture of what the viral protein looks like, but more importantly, how it inhibits a key component in the interferon signaling pathway. So having that picture, we can use that to our advantage to develop therapeutics, for example, small molecules that can prevent or drugs that can prevent that interaction and potentially inhibit virus.
So now you've got a picture of the effect and how the Ebola virus actually impacts the immune system. And I wonder if you could talk about this new discovery, this new treatment that has been tried now on monkeys that have the Marburg virus, which is very similar to the Ebola virus.
This is the study that just came out yesterday, and I think it's very, very exciting because one of the things that we've seen with fast-moving viruses that replicate very rapidly, and the and patients sort of the clinical symptoms change very rapidly, is that we need multiple therapeutic modalities, and so we've seen the previous studies and some of the patients being treated with monoclonal antibodies. And I think the therapeutic window for that is very early, and I don't think we have a very good sense of exactly what we have right now. And those typically monoclonal antibodies prevent the viral entry. And so the new study looking at RNAi technology and a way to deliver RNAi against three different viral proteins, and coincidentally, one of those three proteins that's targeted is VP24. So this is, and the other one is VP35. These are both immune antagonists. So what that study is showing is that if we prevent the production of viral proteins in infected cells, again, you can potentially treat it. And in this particular study, it was really exciting to see because the what they were able to show was that they could go as long as 3 days post-exposure to a virus, and where the animals began to show some symptoms of disease, that they were able to still 16 out of 16 animals survive. So that is really, really exciting.
And, of course, today we heard that two aid workers who were being treated with an experimental treatment in the U.S. have now been released from the hospital. What treatment is being used there, and is that something that could be effective with other people experiencing Ebola?
Right. I mean, not having been associated directly with the studies, I have access to any of the information, so I can't really comment other than just what I've seen in the news. And I think at least the initial reports suggested that they used the antibody cocktail that MAP Biopharmaceuticals developed called ZMAP. So that appears to have, based on the news reports at least, it appears to have three different monoclonal antibodies. And then I think that's as far as my information goes. So.
And what does it mean that they have three different monoclonal antibodies?
So these are antibodies that specifically bind to a protein that's on the outside of the virus, and by binding to a protein that's important for viral entry, it prevents the infection at the beginning. So it prevents the virus from entering new cells.
Well, and obviously, as you're just discovering the ways that Ebola attaches itself and ways that that can be treated, there's not going to be time for full clinical trials. Do you see ethical considerations with putting some of these treatments out without the full series of trials that are usually required?
I mean, I think that is a very, very difficult question to answer, because I think people, I think the WHO panel concluded that it would be reasonable to, under certain guidelines to use some of these. And I think there are a number of investigators and a number of doctors who are in the field who would have to make the decision. And again, the patients and doctors will have to make that decision, because I think, it's very difficult to say from far away from the outbreak, what types of treatments we should do. But, one of the things I hope that this outbreak would do is to accelerate some of the available treatments that are in the pipeline to go through, like you said, the safety testing and efficacy testing and hopefully they'll be ready sooner rather than later.
Well, I do want to thank you for this update. I've been speaking with Dr. Gaya Amarasinghe with the Washington University School of Medicine, lead investigator in a new report on a new discovery about the Ebola virus and how it attaches to cells and the effect on the immune system. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Sam Bowman. The semiconductor giant Intel Corporation is close to securing a tax deal with local governments in Washington County that could save it an estimated $2 billion over the next 30 years. The deal will allow Intel to conduct $100 billion of investment, free from property taxes, most of which will be invested in equipment. In return, Intel will pay so-called full freight property taxes on its buildings and land and pay $2.9 million annually for 20 years, as well as fees and charitable contributions adding up to no more than a few million dollars every year. Intel is based in Silicon Valley, but most of its development and largest manufacturing facilities are located in Hillsboro. Manufacturing plants for semiconductors and microprocessors are incredibly capital-intensive, and Intel is currently building a huge research and manufacturing facility, called a fab, in Hillsboro called D1X. The fab was begun in 2010 and will cost billions of dollars to construct and outfit with machinery and tools. The tax deal is taking place under the Strategic Investment Program, or SIP, established by the Oregon legislature in 1993 after extensive lobbying from Intel. Intel and local governments have established five previous deals under the SIP, but this current one would be the longest lasting at 30 years and would replace the existing one, which is still in effect. The company began negotiating the deal earlier this summer, around the time it donated $5,000 to the Political Action Committee of Washington County Commissioner Andy Dyke. Intel says the deal is necessary for it to feel confident in investing so much money in the new plant and future projects, while some observers have expressed worry that the deal is taking money away from Oregon schools and other projects. A public hearing on the deal will be held next Tuesday, the 26th, at Hillsboro City Hall. For more on the deal and the controversy surrounding it, I spoke today with Jody Weiser of Tax Fairness Oregon. Can you just explain for us a little bit the basic numbers of this deal, which is called the Strategic Investment Program? How does Intel benefit, and how would Washington County benefit from it?
Basically, Intel benefits from it because it has to pay very little tax on all the expensive equipment inside their buildings. And Washington County benefits from it because they get to, they think they get to keep Intel and keep Intel happy, and they also get to take a large part of the money they get from Intel and not share it with the schools. And so that gives more to the city of Hillsboro and Washington County.
You mentioned schools, so will Intel's payments benefit any other Oregon schools outside of the Hillsboro district?
Whenever they have distributed money to schools, and they used to distribute the Intel fees to schools, they've just stopped more recently. But what they've always done is distribute it based upon where Intel students go to school in Washington County. So, for instance, Beaverton and Forest Grove have no Intel facilities, but they have plenty of residents whose kids are in their schools, and so they've been getting a piece of any funding passed on to education.
So how much does Intel stand to save in this deal over the coming 30 years?
So Intel, if they fully use this this benefit, and that would mean that they would invest $100 billion, about 3 to 4 times more than they've invested so far in Oregon. They would save $3 billion, according to Roy Rogers, who is the chief negotiator for Washington County. That's on a scenario they ran that said they had two investments of $50 billion each. So far, they've only invested $25 to $30 billion in Oregon. So, you know, that's over 38 years. So who knows what they will actually do. Intel is making absolutely no promises with this agreement. Basically, the county commission and the city council will be making, if they sign off on it, they will be agreeing that Intel pays low taxes if they stay here and invest up to $100 billion.
Intel and Washington County have both said that that this deal would give the appearance of Oregon having a business-friendly environment that might attract more businesses. Is that accurate or is that disingenuous?
Oregon already, according to a study released just yesterday by Coast, which is a business-oriented think tank, COST is an acronym, I don't remember.
Council on State Taxation.
Right. Oregon has the lowest taxes in the country for businesses. We also have the cheapest energy. We also have plenty of land available. Because people move here, we have an educated workforce. So we are already a very business-friendly state. We don't really need to do anything to prove it further. It's just a nice... it's a nice claim to make when you're trying to get a deal for yourself.
Would that deal benefit other businesses in Oregon?
Well, other businesses could get the same deal if they were investing a huge amount of money. The SIP is available. It's an available tax program of the state. It's just never been, nobody has ever asked for a 30-year contract before. And in fact, we wonder if it's even legal.
And also, the 30-year contract, it stipulates that Intel would make a regular payment to the state. And would that be adjusted for inflation?
No, nothing in it is adjusted for inflation except the taxes on the $100 million worth of equipment. Currently, they have about $6.9 billion of investment under this program, the SIP program, and $500 million of it is land and buildings. They pay a fee on that, not a regular tax. It is the amount they would pay in property taxes, but because of the fee, it doesn't get shared with the schools. And then they pay taxes on $100 million of the $6.4 billion that is left. And that number goes up 3% a year, just like your taxes and my taxes do. But the basic start, you know, it starts at $100 million. That's the same number they had in 1994. So if that number had been adjusted for inflation by this agreement, it would be $175 million that they'd pay taxes on, or a 75% increase.
Your organization, Tax Fairness Oregon, what are you folks trying to accomplish around this deal?
What we'd like them to do is go back to the table and have the negotiators for the city and the county ask for a deal that really takes care of the public interest, not just Intel's interest. It should all be indexed to inflation. All the numbers in it should be. Otherwise, we're saying, well, Intel's expecting to have increased costs, but the public services have remained at the same price they were in 1993, and they'll stay that way for another 30 years. Of course, that's not realistic at all. And also, it should not be for 30 years. The people who are elected to serve now are tying the hands of city council members and the county commission members and the state legislators for the next 30 years. It's not really fair to make a decision that ties everybody else's hands so that they couldn't negotiate a better deal if they wanted to.
Do you know what is the current voting schedule on on this deal?
Well, I saw the agenda. The original plan was they would have a public hearing Tuesday evening starting at 7, and they would vote immediately thereafter, which is kind of like, well, we'll have a public hearing, but we'll have one, but we won't even sleep on it and think about what people said. We're just going to vote as soon as the public hearing is over. But today I saw the agenda, and I didn't see a vote on the agenda, so maybe they've decided to put it off. The hearing is at the Washington County Administrative Building at 155 North Main in Hillsborough at 7. And they're going to take testimony. People should be prepared to come and talk.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Jody Weiser of Tax Fairness Oregon.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock. Next is Rose City Native Radio. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland on Friday, August 22nd. This month, co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents El Cuadro Gallo. Featuring Christina Lawrence, accompanied by Jeffrey Trapp on guitar, Paul Brady on cante, Nick Hutch on cajon, and Brenna McDonald on palmas. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland and El Cuadro Gallo on Friday, August 22nd at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in